Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming. It's so great to see such a packed audience. But I am not at all surprised because it is such an honour to have James O'Brien here with us tonight and his excellent new book. Now, sometimes I have to do these in conversations. I have to sort of blag and pretend that I've read the book and I haven't really. I've kind of skimmed it. Such is my enjoyment. I have flagged and tagged literally every single page. I have studied this. It's such a fantastic, absorbing, intelligent, clever, thought-provoking, but accessible book as well. It really is fantastic. I should do your PR for it, honestly. Like, really, we should get a deal going or something. So we're going to have a fantastic evening. We're going to start with James is going to give us a kind of 10-minute overview of his thinking about the book. I'm going to have an in-conversation with him, and then we're going to open it up to questions. So, ladies and gentlemen, please show your appreciation for the great James O'Brien.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for coming along as well. Unlike Aisha, I haven't read it. I don't know. I've also just realised as I got here that I'm currently wearing the shirt that I wore on the day that photograph was taken. So just in case Mum's watching the live stream, I do own lots and lots of shirts. I don't just have the single one. I mean, the short answer to why I wrote this book is because somebody asked me to. And the reason they asked me to is because of these infernal clips that started going bonkers about 3 or 4 years ago. The first one was something of an attack upon the disgraced former editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie, with regard to his despicable conduct towards the survivors and the grieving families of the Hillsborough tragedy. And I was walking up Berwick Street. There's a comic shop at the bottom of Berwick Street. And I went in to buy a comic. And the bloke behind the counter, very earnest scouter, went, "Can I just say thank you very much for what you did this morning?" And I'm, "Yeah, of course you can. Were you listening to the show?" And he said, "No, I saw it on Facebook." I said, "Well, do you ever listen to the show?" He said, "Mate, I have no idea who you are. I just saw this thing on Facebook." And weirdly, I realised at that point that something a bit different and a bit special was happening, and that internet media, which should have been an enemy of traditional media, everybody at the time was having kittens about the threat that the internet might pose to all of us in traditional broadcast. It still does pose a huge threat to many elements of traditional broadcast. But these bite-sized clips started going around the world at a rate of knots that none of us could have foreseen or predicted. My bosses, I think I can tell you this, keep it under your hat, but my bosses thought, because I work in the same building as Capital Radio and Heart and various other cooler brands, my bosses thought that the clips, when they made all our studios space age, they thought the clips that would go nuts would be stuff like Lady Gaga coming in to talk to Moyles on Radio X, or Take That coming in to talk to Jamie and Emma on Heart. But they don't do any business at all. Weirdly, me wanging on about Amber Rudd got 4 million views, while Lady Gaga and Moyles gets about 13. But, you know, we are where we are. So when I was trying to work out why these clips had proved so effective, and in many ways changed the whole face of my job, my career, it suddenly occurred to me that stuff we'd been doing for years without really noticing, and certainly without being conceited enough to think that it was extraordinary, actually wasn't being done in many other places. This is entirely serendipity on my part. It's got no planning or particular gift. It was entirely serendipity, because what I realised about 5 years ago is I was getting a bit bored of being a radio phone-in host. And the reason I was getting bored of being a radio phone-in host is because all we ever really did was ask, what do you think? What is your opinion on immigration, or is Islamic fundamentalism, or feminism? What is your opinion? What is the answer to knife crime? More stop and search, James. As soon as you said why, I started saying why a few years ago. It kind of flies in the face of the format's traditional model. You're supposed to just cue people up, let them have their say, and then move on to the next one. And that has its purposes, it has its uses. But as soon as we started saying why, that's when we started hitting pay dirt and discovering that people possessed of incredibly pungent opinions, people who are sufficiently convinced by their own rectitude that they will phone up a radio station, which is quite an odd thing to do. Put your hand up if you've ever phoned a radio station. Weirdos, absolute freaks. Twice, mate, you need help. You see what I mean, though? Because you have to be so persuaded of your own correctness that it's a very, very, very confident thing to do. And so what we started discovering, with all the sort of hardy perennials that are covered in this book, the issues are immigration, Islam, Brexit, which of course came along a little later, LGBT, political correctness, feminism, nanny state. What does the nanny state? Say to someone, that's a great example, what does the nanny state mean? Oh, well, they're trying to stop us from eating what we want to eat. Like poison? I mean, you know, there's laws governing poison. Why wouldn't you have laws governing stuff that makes you really, really fat, or stuff that makes you really, really poorly, or illegal drugs? Is that the nanny state as well? And as soon as you start asking these questions, what do you mean by the actual words? Amazing things started happening, and that's why the clips started going nuts, and that's why I finally felt confident enough to actually write a book about it. And all of these words, classical liberal, what do people mean when they say that? It just means they're not very good at sharing. That's pretty much where classical liberalism in the modern 21st century social media filtered meaning of the word comes from. It's a kind of taxpayers' alliance type rhetoric. We want less tax. What they never say is, of course, we want fewer police officers. We want fewer soldiers. We want, you know, worse roads. We want fewer hospitals. We want worse schools. We want fewer police officers, firefighters, doctors, nurses. They just say we want lower taxes. So you ask people what they actually mean, and you get much more illuminating and enlightening responses. All that needs to happen now is for many of my colleagues in the broadcast media to start asking these questions of the professional commentators, the politicians, the demagogues, and the sort of low-rent hate preachers who come out with these slogans and these meaningless, fatuous, but very provocative phrases and never get asked to define exactly what they mean. So I thought I'd briefly share with you some of the phrases that aren't really picked up in the book. And there's a couple of exceptions, some of them are. But phrases that have entered into common parlance now with a very pejorative flavour, as if we almost don't stop to ask ourselves whether this should actually be something that is presented to us as a negative. Phrases which have been put through the filter of right-wing newspapers usually, and the Daily Mail, of course, in recent years in particular, and have come out the other side of that sort of Paul Dacre-shaped mangle with an entirely different meaning from what they had when they were fed into the mangle. So let's start with, off the top of my head, sort of, health and safety. Oh, down with health. I'll tell you what I really hate. I hate safety. Safety's for mugs. Why would you want to have health? So that, and then you turn it into a sort of pithy little Mickey take, and you call it elf and safety, and ha 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 ha, and suddenly you're persuading people that it's a really bad idea to have protections in place on building sites. Or possibly sometimes you go a little bit too far with the high-vis jackets, but would you rather have your children riding their bicycles in the dark in high-vis jackets or not in high-vis jackets? So even health and safety, two of the most fundamental prerequisites of a functioning civilization, have, when they are viewed through the lens of the Daily Mail, become negatives. Even more, human rights. Well, I mean, obviously human rights are no use at all, unless you're a human. In which case, you shouldn't really have to work that hard to challenge the notion that human rights, rights that extend to every single human, and therefore, by definition, sometimes have to be extended to people we'd rather didn't have them, human rights are a good thing. Political correctness, or good manners, as most of us would now in retrospect term it. Liberal, you're down with freedom. Do-gooder. Yeah, don't do good. Ever. Then you've got social justice warrior. Warrior is new, but I hadn't really heard about social justice until relatively recently, and the only reason I've become aware of the phrase is because people who fight for it are being maligned, demonised, and somehow blamed for all sorts of society's problems. I could go on, virtue signaller, there's all sorts of things. And that really is why I've written the book, because once you start asking people why they think what they think, you have to start asking them what they mean when they use certain words. And if you start doing that, I think, perhaps, you begin the process of defusing this footballification of British life at the moment, where whatever the issue is, you simply pick your team and then start hurling abuse at the other side, regardless of what's actually happening on the pitch. And if I do write another book, I think I'll probably call it Footballification. Thank you very much.
Well, this book is so, so interesting, and I think the timing of it is fascinating as well, because we are, I mean, we're meeting today as we're going into the midterms. Perhaps America is the ultimate kind of crucible of everything going wrong that you talk about in your book. And there's so much that is right in your book, and there's so much that I think we would all agree with in this room.
Not everyone. It'd be a very dull evening.
Well, maybe not sort of everybody, but how do you get this book, and how do you get your messages to the right people?
Well, this is an odd thing about how things have sort of shaken down for me in the last few years. Is I'm often asked, how on earth can you share a platform with so-and-so? Or how do you feel about the fact that you're on the same radio station as so-and-so? And the answer is pretty simple. I started at LBC about 15 years ago, and it was regarded very much as the sort of house radio station for taxi drivers who were often, but by no means always, of a fairly cliched disposition. And 15 years ago, I didn't have any of these opinions in a particularly strong fashion. But the more I've spoken to people, the more I've realised how much effort is being put into getting people to act against their own interests. That's all. It's not a big scandal or a big breakthrough or a particularly coruscating insight. But listening to other phone-in hosts, particularly from the right, looking at the newspapers that act as their manuals and Bibles, the amount of effort and expenditure put into encouraging people to act against their own interests, whether it is the demonisation, you demonise trade unions, and 20 years later you can sell the idea that the reason why your wages are low is because of all the Polish people that have come over in the last 12 months. If you hadn't demonised trade unions successfully, you never could have got the immigration scaremongering afloat. So I love working in a medium and on a platform that is historically and traditionally beloved of very right-wing people, because there'd be precious little point me working for Guardian FM, would there? Really, because I'd be preaching to the choir every day.
And I mean, the other great thing in the book is there's lots of kind of sort of quite meaty thesis and facts and figures, but it's interspersed with sort of speech bubbles of the conversations you've had with your many listeners. And one of the things you've just touched on, the perennial argument about immigration, and your friend or your anti-friend, Angry Arthur, who rings you up quite a lot, and he sort of delivers fridges. And how do you convince the angry Arthurs? Because he's a classic example, you know, he's obviously incredibly pissed off.
Yes.
And rightly so.
His terms and conditions
are
criminal.
It's absolutely
terrible. Practically Dickensian.
But he blames, like you say, the immigrants, the trade unions. He will not blame his awful bosses, and you're very good about not naming who the household name is, and the government.
That was the lawyers.
And the government. How do you get the Arthurs of this world, see, and also how do you address, I think one of the really interesting things listening to LBC, and I've hosted a few phone-ins myself, is
worried.
That there is this kind of collective bitterness in our society at the moment, which is seeping into a racism and another, and you call it an infection, which is quite strong language, but I agree with you. What do we do about it? You've analysed and sort of, you've done the diagnosis brilliantly. What is the prescription?
Truth, I think. So the fellow that Aisha refers to works in conditions that I don't think most people, most consumers of traditional media will even be fully aware of. He delivers white goods, and he needs to have a mate who, because fridges are quite heavy, obviously, and he doesn't actually have an employer. He is, by requirement, officially self-employed, as is his mate. And they pay the company whose logo is on the side of the van that he drives every day for the privilege of driving that van. And then they get paid per job, obviously with the intention that they'll do more jobs, they'll earn more money doing the jobs than they're paying for the use of the truck. But if he gets sick and he has to take a day off, it is incumbent upon him to find somebody, often at very short notice, who will drive the truck instead. The same for his mate. Now, that's not as easy as it sounds. You know, even with the proliferation of zero-hours contracts and sundry other very, very troubling working conditions, quite often, if he can't work, and it doesn't happen to him very often, but if, for example, he broke his leg, and I had a caller that happened to, he has to pay for the van when he's not working. Now, I think when I explain that to people, they will probably realise that they should be getting a little bit more concerned and angry about that happening in this country to hundreds of thousands of people every single day, then they should be getting angry about, for example, I don't know, 36 students in Manchester who've decided to take a Rudyard Kipling poem off their wall and replace it with Maya Angelou. And of course, what's normally happening, to go back to your first question about working where I work, is quite a lot of effort has been put into persuading the listeners to get really cross about the students and the poem in Manchester, which is ridiculous, right? Whereas this guy is blaming immigration for the fact that his working terms and conditions are pretty close to 19th century. So I think, honestly, and maybe cynicism will cure me of this optimism, but it hasn't yet. I just think if you can keep getting it out there, then eventually people like him will realise that he should, because his colleagues, his foreign colleagues, who he blames for the fact that he's got such rubbish terms and conditions, are on exactly the same terms and conditions as him. So he's somehow blaming his unsatisfactory professional existence on people with exactly the same unsatisfactory professional existence. And it never really crosses his mind to ask, well, how come they can do this to us? Because he has been robbed of the idea that he is part of an us. He's him and they're them. And it's their fault. His job is rubbish. And the bosses are laughing all the way to the bank. And I think if you can get the little nuggets, the oyster knives, to shuck open these issues, make them simple, comprehensible, digestible, I think most people will, I think pennies will drop. And they tend to. I mean, people tell me that they do.
Well, I mean, there are some kind of moments of, conversion in your, in some of the phone calls that you have. I think there's a guy who rings up who's been really angry about immigrants and Islam, and I think his wife takes him in hand.
That was really poignant, because I had a friend who got caught up in the EDL stuff quite early on, and a good friend of mine, one of my oldest, closest friends, and he went a bit mad. I mean, he started watching these videos of people who, tragically, are probably better known now than they were then, but sort of old American ideologues and evangelical Christians and some of the people who write for magazines like The Spectator and don't get called racist or Islamophobic because they went to public school and they wear pocket watches. And he started falling under their spell. And it started frightening me because, you know, I know a lot of Muslim people and they are not terrorists or terrorist apologists or terrorist sympathisers. And he lives in Notting Hill Gate and was under the impression that this stuff the EDL did was true. And he kind of got better. So I talked about him on air and took a call from an amazing bloke. And all he did, it's a very short transcript, this, all he did was put his laptop under his sofa, because the question I kept asking was, do you know any people who believe what you're being told all Muslims believe? And no, I don't. I don't know any, but there's millions of them. I said, well, if there's really millions of them, why haven't you come across any ever? And also, the bloke that does your accounts, or the bloke that sells you your milk, or the bloke that operated on your wife last year, they're all Muslims. So why are you buying into this idea? And his wife, this guy, Ray, I think his name was.
Yeah, Ray.
He was, his wife basically said, mate, darling rather, I don't think she calls his wife. Darling, you're frightening me. You're turning into someone I don't recognise. You're angry all the time. You're bending people's ears about this stuff all the time. And he said, I put my laptop away. I put it under the sofa. That's it. We've all done it. He just tuck it under the sofa. And he said, within a week, I was sorted. It saved my marriage, James. Why are we letting people like him be turned into furious pots of untapped, incoherent rage? And the damage it will do eventually, it already is, isn't it?
And to society, but to them individually.
Well, that's
as well.
That's what I care more about. I mean, you care about society on a meta level, but it's a little bit worthy, it's a bit sanctimonious. I really care about the fact that his wife was frightened of him. And if he's got the, you know, if he pays me the honour of tuning into the radio programme every day, then I think there's a sort of Reithian duty to shine light into the dark corners of the other misinformation that he's receiving.
But the misinformation is interesting because, as well as the bosses laughing all the way to the banks, you could argue that, and you make a very powerful point in your epilogue, that the media bosses are kind of laughing all the way to the bank, not just the right-wing editors, but the producers on the news. And you have this wonderful phrase where you say that, you know, quite a lot of people are invested in ignorant fury than a more peaceful truth.
Yes.
And I think that is on an individual basis, but that's definitely what a lot of, you know, the kind of media proprietors, both in broadcast and in print, as we know. And a lot of people keep saying, look, you know, people don't buy newspapers anymore, but we know they're hugely influential. If you work in broadcast, when you go in and you're deciding what stories you're going to do, whether you're producing the 6 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news or a talk radio show, you pore over the newspapers, the editorials, the... I mean, how... In a post-Leveson world, what do you think the influence of the newspapers are still? And even though Paul Dacre has left, how pernicious are the right-wing newspapers in terms of perpetuating and dripping this sort of
I've written for them. I did, to declare an interest straight away, I was on the Daily Express. It wasn't right-wing at the time. It was a strange experiment in popular liberalism presided over by Rosie Boycott. But if I'd needed to pay my mortgage and pay my bills after Richard Desmond bought the newspaper, then I would have done. I'm not here to castigate or condemn anybody who still does. And then I didn't exercise much influence over the editorial line of the Daily Mail when I was their video games editor, but I certainly cashed their cheque. I was certainly happy to cash the cheques and take the money. It seemed to me to go a bit more bonkers than before, 4 or 5 years ago. And then as the possibility of Brexit happening began to occur, a lot of reason and regulation, self-regulation, went out the window, culminating after the result in those rancid... that rancid triumvirate of front pages, looking at Crush the Saboteurs, Enemies of the People, and the other one that I've forgotten, but it was a rancid triumvirate of front pages.
It was rancid, whatever it was, it was rancid.
No, it really was. And you realise that there is no attempt there to provide news or information to the readers. All there is an attempt to shore up the largely prejudice-driven decision that has been taken largely as a result of the prejudices being peddled by these newspapers. It's really boring, and it's really predictable, and it's really two-dimensional, but it happens to be true. Clichés often are. And the damage done, for my money, to the people I talk to every day. Remember, Paul Dacre has never spoken to any of these people. He never will. There's a great story about him in the book Mailmen, published last year, about how he never has to buy new shoes. Do you know why? Because he never walks on anything other than carpet. He gets out of his chauffeur-driven car, he crosses about 6 foot of Kensington pavement, and then he's back into the executive suite at the Daily Mail. He gets back into his chauffeur-driven car, he gets taken home, he gets taken to his club, he gets taken to his shooting estate in Scotland, he gets taken to his gated community. He doesn't speak to any of these people, but he tells them every day to be terrified, to be full of hate, to be angry, to be bitter, to blame their neighbour for everything that's gone wrong in their life. He tells them every single day not to trust anyone, not to believe in the sort of healing power of love and redemption and peace. He tells Crush the Saboteurs, Enemies of the People, our Remainer universe, academics can't be trusted, parliamentary sovereignty can't be trusted, the rule of law, High Court judges can't be trusted. Now, think about this list of institutions that a man whose entire career has been built on defending British values. He hasn't got a British value left. He's maligned sovereign parliament. He's maligned functioning democracy as represented by MPs who disagree with him. They're the saboteurs. The enemies of the people are the High Court judges. That's the rule of law that's under attack. Freedom of the press? Psh, not really. And so the point is that then filters through, as Aisha says, to everything being about heat and not light. So even on programmes that you would think, and certainly when I was young, were paragons of objectivity, are going to be judged according to how much traffic they generate on social media. What are they saying on Twitter? If you want this Twitter to explode, then you book one of these vile sort of peddlers of really, really lazy prejudices, and hopefully they'll say something in the course of question time that's really outrageous, and then everyone will go nuts, and maybe someone in the audience will stand up and say something even more obnoxious and vile, and that will go absolutely bonkers, and everyone will high-five each other on the way home, but they don't have to reap what is sown by prioritising heat over light. Ray's wife does, you know, and so do millions of other people in this country, not just the people who are on the receiving end of the manufactured anger and the very deliberately provoked fury and fear. Not just the people on the receiving end of it, the Polish people being spat at in the street, the Spanish woman being told to stop speaking Spanish on a train, but the people who were telling her, I genuinely believe this, the people who were expressing that hatred and that vitriol, I think they're victims too.
And do you know, you have such strong, ardent views on this. How does it make you feel when your own radio station does have, you know, Nigel Farage, I mean, Katie Hopkins wasn't there anymore. But you know, some pretty divisive characters. How does that make you? How does that make you feel? And how do you feel when, I mean, I don't know if you have much to do with them personally or whether you have to do much with them personally, but how does that make you feel? Because you make a very powerful point. Yeah. And often the clips that Nigel Farage says go viral. You have Jacob Rees-Mogg on sometimes doing guest presenting as well. And that's feeding that kind of, that sort of social media pot as well.
I felt that Hopkins was beyond the pale. I felt that Cockroach's column should have been the end of any career in the public place. If you poison the well in the marketplace as deliberately, as cynically, and as dangerously as that, you should be drummed out of town. So by all means, carry on spouting your nonsense in dark corners of the internet or head over to Speaker's Corner. But there has to be a standard below which professional broadcasters being paid by established broadcasting companies should not be allowed to fall. Farage is different. He's an elected politician. The Spanish woman who got spat out in the street recently for speaking Spanish or on the train, of course, that's a direct, that process stems back to his comments about hearing people speaking foreign on a train. And of course, his estranged wife speaks German to his half-German children. So my job is to keep pointing this stuff out. You can't stop people being free to express opinions you find unpleasant, but if they start telling lies, and the hypocrisy as well. Here's an interesting thing, you may not have picked up on this yet. The FT profiled Aaron Banks today, and the financial stuff, of course, is still very much under scrutiny, but what is not under scrutiny, what is an established fact, is that Aaron Banks gave a character witness for his paedophile headmaster when he was on trial for abusing Banks's school friends and classmates. The headmaster was convicted, and then Banks, a few years later, took to Facebook to malign and criticise the survivors whose testimony had saw this paedophile jailed as being members of a victim culture. Now, Banks, if you just Google his name and the former leader of the EDL, the artist formerly known as Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, if you just Google that in juxtaposition, the first thing that will come up is Banks weighing in on Yaxley-Lennon's side, apparently outraged that paedophiles don't get locked up. Now that, to me, is a story, because it makes him not only a paedophile apologist and a victim blamer, it also makes him the mother of all hypocrites who is basing his criticism of the grooming gangs that are made up of predominantly British men of Pakistani origin. You have to ask yourself, how come that kind of paedophile is the scum of the earth and we must not rest until they've all been jailed? But this kind of paedophile, I'm going to stand up in court and give him a character reference?
Well,
that's my job.
And I have to say on that, I listened to one of your shows last week, and it was on the grooming gangs, and there was an extraordinary call from a woman called Katie.
Yes.
From Rotherham, and it was so powerful because the debate was raging about how you could, you know, whether the race should be an issue or not. And it was one of these phone calls where I literally had to stop what I was doing. And everything was challenged. I think you were challenged
hugely
as well. And she was a young woman who had grown up in Rotherham and made the case that actually a lot of the men who had abused her and who were now,
she didn't think she'd been abused. It was commonplace for 13 and 14-year-old girls to be the girlfriends of men in their late teens and their early 20s. But these were white men and they were having what they thought were functioning relationships. So she still, and I didn't want to tell her, because, you know, we cope with stuff that happens to us in a variety of different ways. But legally, of course, she was a victim of abuse. And she was cross about the portrayal of the problem as being unique to grooming gangs consisting of men largely of Pakistani origin. Because, of course, it means that all the men that were statutory raping 13 and 14-year-old girls in her childhood who were white, and not only got off scot-free, but also, she said, they're often the ones on Facebook who are going in hardest on the perception that this is a problem unique to brown-skinned men. I mean, those are the calls that stop everyone in their tracks,
I think you had a subsequent caller as well who, again, just shone this incredibly compelling and brutal and honest light on how vulnerable girls are treated in this society.
By society.
By men of all colours and societal structures, which was fascinating. Now, I feel we haven't mentioned the B word yet. Can you guess what it is? And what do you think is going to happen on Brexit? Just thought I'd put it out there. You know, just throw them a little. I've done some nice gentlemen. This is kind of
I don't know at the moment, which is for the first time. I honestly believed that by now things would be a lot better than they are, and that I'd have gone back to relative obscurity, wanging on about parking tickets and asking when the phones wouldn't ring, asking if there's anybody old out there feeling poorly who just wanted to ring in and help me fill an hour. Because I just presumed, that there were some grown-ups around the corner. I presumed, and listen, I've got no beef with people who voted to leave the European Union because various pledges and promises were made. And my own vote in the end was quite ill-informed. It was based more upon the fear, possibly because of what I get exposed to in the work that I do, the fear that the vote would throw a huge amount of red meat to some profoundly unpleasant people, both in the public eye, like Mr. Farage, and of course not in the public eye. And I think I was right about that, but I didn't necessarily mean Brexit would be bad. But when I started learning, by talking to hauliers at Dover about what was going to happen to the border at Dover, rather than talking to Nadine Dorries or Owen Paterson, I spoke to people that actually drive the lorries, that actually fill in the order paperwork, that actually do the car nets. The difference, for example, if you're driving an articulated lorry full of concert equipment through Europe at the moment, there's checks at either end. But once we leave the European Union, it's going to be almost impossible to do things like that, because you have to prove that you're not dropping some of it off in Frankfurt and then leaving some of it in Dusseldorf. And if you're playing in Paris on Thursday night, you need to prove that you've brought everything from Berlin when you played on Tuesday night. And you need paperwork to do this. So you speak to the people that are doing it rather than the ideologues that were selling it. And you realise, oh, this is going to be a bit tricky. This is going to be really complicated. And there's one man I remember from about a week before the vote. And I was in a, I can't remember why, I was in a bit of a ratty mood. I was at one of my favourite places in the world. I think my wife had said we weren't allowed to have fish and chips that day and we were going to go and have to have something healthier. So I was in a right old bait.
Oh my God, the struggle is real, James. Yeah, the struggle is real, people. It really
so
is.
So I'm strolling up and down the seafront in Wells next to sea in Norfolk, and there's a perfectly charming fella in those red trousers. I don't know. There's a level of poshness you have to achieve. Yes. And when you achieve that level of poshness, they tell you where the red trouser shop is. It's like a secret handshake. And he's marching up and down on Wells next to seafront in Norfolk in a Panama hat and bright red trousers, handing out the leaflets. And I just, and Lucy and the kids were in the, I think they were in the arcade, in the penny arcade, and I had the dog. And I just thought, oh, come on then, in for a penny, in for a pound. And I just said to him, excuse me, old boy, what do you think is going to happen in Ireland? It's a week before the referendum. Oh, don't you worry about Ireland. Everything will be absolutely... Well, I kind of do worry about Ireland because, you know, a lot of people died. And there's a peace agreement in place. And even the most cursory reading of this peace agreement is going to make Brexit really, really difficult to do. But even I thought I must be wrong. I kind of went with it. I thought, well, don't be daft. We wouldn't have a national debate on the scale that we're having. We wouldn't have elected parliamentarians and highly paid columnists and pundits and professional commentators blithely reassuring us that everything was absolutely fine and there was nothing to worry about if there wasn't even a kernel of truth in it. Until really recent, and do you know what? I still haven't given up on this naive belief that there must be a kernel of truth in it somewhere, because the alternative is too bonkers to contemplate. All of these people, all of these columnists, all of these editors, all of these politicians, these cabinet ministers, these self-appointed patriots, who actually have been talking more or less undiluted claptrap since pretty much day one. And I thought by now I would feel silly, because it would be, yeah, you see, look, some of us have got our unicorns, or some of us have got our improved lives. And here's a long list of all the laws that you're going to have your life improved by no longer having to obey. Here is something more than a blue passport that represents a substantive and tangible improvement on your life. I genuinely thought by now there'd be a little bit of humble pie on the table. And I look, this will sound a bit silly and probably a bit pompous, but if there is going to be humble pie on the table, I'll eat it all. I would rather live on humble pie for the rest of my life than see what I think we might be edging towards come to fruition. Because what we seem to be edging towards is the best case scenario is if Theresa May can convince the extremist fringe of her own party to do something that's slightly better than absolutely awful. Happy Christmas.
Jazz hands, everyone. I mean, your Brexit calls, I think, are absolutely fascinating to listen to. I mean, They're exhausting, they're repetitive, they're hard.
You're really selling the show. No, right,
but that's the kind of the thing of Brexit.
They're exhausting repetition.
But I just wanted to ask, like, sometimes, do you hate your listeners sometimes?
Never.
Do you not feel sometimes when, you know, you've had your eighth call of the morning?
Never, no, because it's not there. I mean, again, it's going to be patronising and condescending, and let me get this right from the editor of The Sun. The epitome of a smug, sanctimonious, condescending, obsessively politically correct, champagne socialist, public schoolboy, Ramona. I will now sound like that. It's not their fault. Again, imagine the confidence you need to ring up a radio station, a national radio station, and say that you are not remotely racist and you're supremely comfortable about immigration, and the reason you want to leave the European Union is because you're sick of obeying all those laws.
And then you ask them which laws?
Every single time.
And they say
time.
Bananas.
Every single time.
Bananas is
time.
The one, apparently. That is the...
Which laws? Oh, loads, James. Any, all right, just one. Just one law. One law that observing curtails in any meaningful way any aspect of your existence. Just one law, because you've now voted. Of course, by now they're claiming that they knew there was going to be economic harm. Oh, I knew there was going to be economic harm. Oh, yes, I absolutely knew there was going to be. Maybe 10 years.
Maybe 50 years.
Maybe 100 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be worth it in the long run. Okay, what is? What is going to be worth it in the long run? Well, we won't have to obey those laws. What laws? There aren't any. Mm. And if there are, it's the baseline of workplace regulations and worker protections, which in many areas we wrote that legislation, and in many more areas our baseline is currently higher than the European Union bare minimum. So in many ways, workplace regulations and employee protections are proof that they don't make our laws, because we've got laws that are more robust and industries that are more regulated than European Union legislation would allow. But of course, if we leave the European Union, then that baseline beneath our baseline disappears. And remember, we had a government in power not long ago which boasted about a bonfire of regulations. A bonfire of regulations being something to celebrate in the country where Grenfell Tower burnt to the ground, largely because of poor regulation. So what do these people want? They want to get rid of that baseline. Do you think when we've got rid of that baseline, they're going to start raising the protections that British workers enjoy? They're going to start bringing in more regulations designed to protect us from exploitative or dangerous working situations? Of course they're not. They want to bring it down.
And in fact, in the last coalition government, there was a review, a Beecroft review, I think, into cutting. And cutting red tape is always cutting.
Yes.
Things like maternity rights and workers' rights.
But they
rights.
Sell it to people. You make it sound like something really unattractive. Red tape. Oh, down with red tape. I don't like red tape. Well, what's the red tape for? Well, it means that if you're operating a lathe at work, it has to have a protective screen in front of it. No one's going to say, down with protective screens that stop me chopping my own arm off every day at work, but down with red tape, down with regulations. Oh, yeah, I hate regulations. And it's foreigners that are bringing in the regulations, you know. It's those pesky bureaucrats, those faceless bureaucrats in Brussels that are stopping me from chopping my own arm off at work. And suddenly, by asking what the words mean and what people think they mean when they say that they believe something, that the story changes completely. Completely.
Now, sometimes when you're debating with your listeners, you obviously have a great intellect, you have good knowledge, you have an argument, you also have an ego.
Yes, you need one.
I don't know if anyone has noticed this. Where does the ego thing come in? How much of an ego do you have to do what you do? Because you are going in and you are doing hand-to-hand combat with people. Do you ever have imposter syndrome? Do you always feel like complete sort of moral and intellectual certainty about what you're arguing?
God, because no. God, no. No, 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 no. Imposter syndrome, yes, but more in the sense of having a job that I love and in recent years a degree of reward and award that I never thought I'd have. So that's when I think there's going to be, that everyone thinks this, if things are going well. Unless you're a sociopath, which brings us back to Brexit. But there's you're waiting for that tap on the shoulder to say, all right, mate, you've had your fun. Yeah, you get back in your box now. Get back to doing your phone-ins about parking tickets and old-age pensions. But the ego, I don't really know. I'm a show-off.
Do you ever feel that sometimes you go in a bit hard on people?
Used to do, not so much anymore. You used to be a bit of a blood sport. But again, it's so emblematic of a much wider malaise that people think, oh, you don't let anyone finish, you cut them off. If you say something that's not true, something that is demonstrably not true, like, for example, we can't control our borders if we're in the European Union, you should not be allowed to get away with it. 2.5 years after that vote, people are still uttering that phrase on national television, radio, every single day. I am aware of household name BBC presenters who conduct Brexit interviews who still aren't fully across the Citizens Charter that determines precisely what member state governments can do to limit the movement, the free movement of workers between member states. 3 months to find a job or demonstrate that you have sufficient wealth not to be a burden upon the state. Countries like Belgium have that in place. BBC household name presenters conducting Brexit interviews still don't know that.
And how do you prepare for your show? Because some you have a great section here where you try...
Like, I have a kebab.
Fight yourself.
Yeah.
But you have a section where you chide interviewers for often sticking to sort of pre-prepared interview questions, not doing their research, not really drilling down. How do you yourself get yourself match fit?
I don't. Look, I'm weird. I genuinely am just a bit weird. My dad was a newspaper journalist. My dad was a proper journalist. My dad worked at the front line of news reporting during a period of epic industrial change in this country. He covered the miners, covered the car industry in the Midlands. He was the Birmingham correspondent of the Daily Telegraph at the end of his career. But he was a tea boy on the Shipley Times and Express on the outskirts of Leeds at the beginning of his career. So he is the doyen, or was, he's no longer with us, the doyen of news journalists. And he used to think, people that do what I do, the phrase that he used to use was, we're in the engine room keeping the ship afloat. They say, your lot are on the deck Morris dancing. And in a way, those roles have been swapped in that the show-offs, the colour writers, the opinion pieces and the columnists have actually now got a lot more prominence on most of these Fleet Street ships than the oily rags and the engineers in the newsroom have. And I, since I was so high, was just exposed to it. I never listened to pop music in the car, always listened to the radio for newspapers delivered to the house, every single one of them, and the locals, you know, the Birmingham Post, the Kidderminster Shuttle, the Worcester Evening News. And I just read them all, and I always have. So I get into work now about 8 o'clock in the morning. I still have a pile of newspapers. Obviously, I've got a lot of young colleagues now, so I have a pair of scissors, and I snip out the stories that I like. And they're sitting there with their iPads and their screens and saying, memo to self, Siri, show me the story about... And I'm going, has anyone seen my scissors? Every single day. Has anybody seen my scissors? And I cut out the stuff I like. I've got a magpie memory, so I remember stuff. But, you know, it just happens to be news stuff. If I'd been raised differently, I might be able to tell you who scored the winning goal in the 1984 FA Cup final. I just happen to be able to tell you what the terms of the Citizens' Charter regarding free movement of people is. I'd probably be a lot more fun at parties if I knew about the
Well, we're
about
very,
the FA
well,
Cup.
Very grateful for your upbringing and your magpie memory.
And I read something and it stays there, which is, you know, again, I worry.
But also, I think you do prepare. I think, you know,
yeah,
you do
well,
prepare.
I read the papers.
Also, you read the papers.
And I swat up.
You have an argument and you are prepared to... As you say, you won't
let
things
go. I'm getting pretty unbearable
go.
Now. I used to have an argument. Now I'll do a 20-minute monologue at the beginning of the programme, at the end of which I'll know what we're talking about. And, and if the ratings go off a cliff, I'm pretty sure they will point out to me that I should probably know what we're talking about at the beginning of the 20-minute monologue.
Right, we are going to go towards you for some questions now. I'm going to take them in clumps of three. And also, just in case any of you are tweeting, the hashtag for this event is hashtag RSA Rights with a capital R. Okay, gentlemen over here at the front first, and I'll go to gentlemen over there. Are there any? And then lady over there.
James, I salute you for crediting your wife for both making you want to be a better man and having taught you that winning an argument doesn't mean that you're right.
Correct.
Having said that, which is a bigger problem, the fake facts or the fact that people have lost the capacity to debunk fallacies?
Okay.
We don't know how to think anymore.
Brilliant question. Thank you very much. A gentleman over there. Yeah. in the glasses, yeah, there, with the white shirt on.
Hi, you mentioned that before your show used to be more of a blood sport, as it were. My Facebook feed seems to show me all of those clips and not much else. So I'm interested in, because it's very interesting to watch, like you leaving yes. a contestant like a guppy fish, and they're like palpably left kind of feeling a bit stupid. But my question would be is, do you still feel that's the right thing to do? And secondly, what happens to those people? Do any of them get back in touch, or do you get back in touch with them?
I have an incredibly well curated.
We're just going to take them in threes, and then we'll just, because we've got time to get through. Lady of the
So I'm a Brexit voter, and I grew up in a federal super state known as the United States of America. And over my lifetime, I watched as power moved from the state level to the federal level, so that there are few people controlling laws for a larger body of people. And I find, in my experience, this has created a lot of resentment, polarity, and strife. I think this is at the root of the problem in America today. So this is the reason I voted Brexit. I despair that Brexit has become a racist issue.
Can we get to your question? Thank you for that. I'm sure we're short of time.
I despair that Brexit has become a racist issue, and I think the sooner we can make this debate, the sooner we can drop the name-calling. Okay. I think I can understand racism. I grew up in America during the Vietnam War with slanty eyes.
Excuse me, could we...
Yes, I do.
I know I'm the outsider here.
Can I finish my question? My question is this. If I know you're very happy with the European Union today, but in 10 years' time,
what's the question?
If you become unhappy with something they do,
yes.
What are you going to do about
Excellent.
It?
Excellent. We finally got there. Round of applause. We got there to the end. We can do that. Okay, great. James, you...
Yes, I'll answer your question first. Vote. And then I'll answer your question.
The poll was taken away.
Yes, because you were... No, but you were going on for quite a long time, to be fair. Okay.
It was a complex question.
Sure. Listen. Come on. I know. Everyone is allowed to... It's not an echo chamber. Listen, there is a clue. Excuse me, please. Okay, please. No. We're not going to call security. We're going to continue having a lovely evening, and James is going to answer your questions. Okay,
so
James.
If politicians do something I don't like, I will exercise my democratic right to vote for or against them, whether at a national level, a supranational level, a state level, or a union level. In fact, arguably, if we'd taken the European Union seriously as a democratic exercise for the last 30 years, instead of letting charlatans like Boris Johnson persuade us that it was a waste of time, we wouldn't have been in the mess that we're in. And if your analysis of American politics is correct, and the polarisation and the hatred that you're seeing on the march, why did Donald Trump call himself Mr. Brexit? Now, the next question would be about the question of blood sports. The clips are brutal, but only because I keep asking the same question. And I don't know what the alternative is, because everywhere else, you can get away with saying something that's not true. The analogy I use, actually, to leave Brexit out of it for a minute, is climate change. And we created a model in this country, for reasons I still don't fully understand, that afforded a blogger and a few people essentially in the pay of the fossil fuel industry, exactly the same validity and weight in a debate-based scenario, in studios that were as august and as authoritative as it's possible to be within the British media, and then you had 95 to 99% of the world's scientists on the other side of the debate. So the analogy for me, if we were to go back a few hundred years, you would have Galileo Galilei sitting here with his Copernican theory of heliocentrism and his actual telescope showing you why he believes that the world revolves around the sun. And then you'd have Nigello Lorsini sitting here with absolutely no evidence whatsoever to back him up, but just a kind of ruddy-faced insistence that this scientist fellow with a telescope didn't know what he was talking about, and the BBC would treat them both equally.
It's false equivalence.
It's utterly false equivalence, and that's why I end up with these people on the show, because they've listened to one half of the argument, presumed it has at least the same weight and the same validity as the other half, and when you start pulling the strings and the threads of their certainties, things fall apart quicker than anybody can imagine. So occasionally, and what happens to them afterwards, I presume that some of my most dedicated trolls on the internet are people who have previously phoned into the programme and soiled themselves on air, but I don't know what else I can do. I can't sit there and let them say things that are not true, just because everybody else does.
And your question about fake, about...
I don't know.
Fake facts.
I don't... It's chicken and egg, isn't it? Fake facts or critic... Well, it's the same thing. So someone believes something that is not true. I think the fishing industry in this country at the moment employs fewer people than Harrods. The idea that leaving the European Union is going to be justified by somehow giving a fillip to the fishing industry is solvable by counting. You just look at numbers. You also look at who owns the fishing boats. You look at who owns the fishing fleet. You look at how much of the catch that's landed in Scotland actually goes to the European Union under the legislation that is determined by freedom of movement of goods. And then you explain this to people, and if they still start querying you, then your second question about what happened to critical thinking. I don't know, but I don't know that you can separate the two or turn one into the chicken. Well, it is chicken and egg. One's a chicken, one's an egg. Which came first? People believing stuff that isn't true, or people surrendering that ability to think for themselves? And Michael Gove coming out with nonsense about the country having had enough of experts can't help much either, can it?
Certainly not. Right, another round of questions. We'll have gentlemen over here, and then there's a lady at the back.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, actually, no, it's a gentleman, sorry. Yeah, gentleman at the back. That's just my eyesight.
There's a chapter on.
There is. And then gentleman there with the blue T-shirt on. Okay, and if we could keep our questions to be pithy and to be questions, please. Thank you very much, because there's tons of people to get through.
Would you do to rescue the BBC?
Very good. Okay.
I'd do subjects without having two guests. I had Sir Paul Nurse on the show the other day. Where's the questioner? I always end up looking into the vague middle distance. I had not on the BBC. I can't really work there anymore because it would involve not being able to be opinionated in my other work. You're allowed to publish The Spectator and be a presenter on the BBC, but you're not allowed to tweet if you're me. I would stop doing these debates. I had Sir Paul Nurse on, Nobel Prize winning scientist, 50 years in the job, talking about, in this instance, the impact that Brexit would have upon scientific research. I just want to listen to Paul Nurse. He's a scientist, he's done 50 years. I don't want then Nadine Dorries coming up to say that he's wrong. I think we have to start revering authority again a bit. And that works the other way, not just all the people I agree with, but all the people whose position is evidence-based. And if there is dissenting voices, represent how dissenting those voices are. So when the People's March happened, the BBC balanced it with news of Farage talking to six men and a dog in Harrogate. But by all means cover Farage talking to six men and a dog in Harrogate, but give it exactly the same coverage as anyone else talking to six men and a dog in Harrogate would get. Don't give it the same coverage as a march that featured just shy of a million people. And cover the march with just shy of a million people in the same way as any other march with just shy of a million people. Don't balance it with a story about a bloke who disagrees with the 700,000 marchers having some sort of weird party in Yorkshire.
And what did you think about the Maher decision to interview Aaron Banks this weekend?
This was fascinating to me.
I will come to the other people.
Three most important words in the English language for me at the moment, and I need to learn this lesson fast and probably more than anybody else, are I don't know. Quite when we became a society that thinks you have to be utterly convinced of one position or another and then fight furiously with the other lot until only one of you is left standing, I don't know when that started happening. So for me as a journalist, everyone would do that interview. But all the lawyers I know were worried that it was ill-advised. And then it finally comes down to the analysis of how Andrew conducted it. And that's a shame, because that's not the first principle. And for my money, the way that Banks was allowed to smear Carol Cadwalader was, editorially, that was pretty iffy, but not iffy enough to say that he should never have been on the programme in the first place.
Gentleman at the back, yep.
Yeah, James, I think my question is about is around language and imaging. I watched with horror in the last few years as people with intentions to divide and to sort of bring about hatred and that sort of thing managed to convince more people on both sides of the Atlantic. And those who want to do right in a world gone wrong just haven't been able to communicate the message in a very punchy way, in a very creative, branded way to convince people. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about people who say they have the best words, the greatest words, and use the simplest and dumbest words, and the most divisive words, manage to get more people on side than people who want to do the right thing. Where are the people who want to do right failing in terms of the use of language and creativity? Yeah, that's a question.
Excellent.
In a nutshell, and in one of my most oft-repeated phrases on the programme, it is a hell of a lot easier to sell tickets for the ghost train than it is for the Speak Your Weight machine. And that's what we do. We sell tickets for the Speak Your Weight machine. And no one really wants to know their weight, and it's boring, and it's not very exciting, and it doesn't relieve endorphins, and it doesn't give you a sort of frisson of fear or anger or adrenaline. And then the bloke over there is selling tickets for the ghost train. Ghosts might not exist, but he's selling tickets for the ghost train, and he's frightening you. So I suspect the answer has to be twofold. You need to start addressing the divisive rhetoric a lot more directly, and not, to go back to the previous question, not saying, of course, on the other hand, there was something the other day the BBC tweeted, wasn't there? And I'm not going to remember what it was, despite boasting about my magpie memory. They deleted it shortly afterwards, but it was something about, it was something that was stone cold fascism. And they said, or is it just a reflection of our politically correct times? And that's the thing that needs to change. Stop balancing out locking up children and taking them away from their parents with someone in a Western liberal free society who will come on and say, no, that's absolutely fine. There have to be objective standards beyond which we as civilized societies do not stray. And we've got to stop inviting and treating with respect the people who are encouraging members of free Western liberal societies to be less free. Less liberal and more and more right-wing. And in terms of the language, we need to be funnier. Need to be funnier, need to be more charming, need to be more winning, need to be more human, and we need to be warmer.
To that gentleman's very good question, do you think it is just the right that is perpetuating this kind of, you know, simplistic language? You know,
I would rather, it used to be when I was a newspaper journalist, I was a showbiz editor when I left newspapers, and I didn't think at that stage in my career that there was any constituency of British society more vitriolic and vengeful than Cliff Richard fans. If you said or did, I did whatever the precursor of Good Morning Britain was once, and I thought a little bit of light banter, taking the mickey out of Cliff Richard. It was a 10-minute walk from the studio back to my office at the Daily Express, and in that 10 minutes, the whole of my voicemail was full, and one of them, I'll never forget it. So just a lovely sounding old lady, I said, if you ever say anything bad about, no, she said, don't say anything bad about Cliff again. And there's this endless pause. And she goes, or else. and since then, I've become a reluctant student of vengeful and vitriolic constituencies. And I can say with my hand on my heart that criticising Jeremy Corbyn unleashes the dogs of hell on a scale that is at least comparable and probably exceeds anything that I get from the right.
Well, I got one of the most horrible tweets I got was somebody messaging me saying, at Aisha Hazarika, why don't you spend less time slagging off Jeremy Corbyn and more time down the gym? That was from my mum. Seriously, she's anyway, gentleman over there, there was a gentleman with the blue T-shirt on who I think wanted to... Can we get a microphone? Oh, yes, you have one. Lovely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this evening, by the way. And thank you for your programme. I always thought it was a brilliant exercise in cognitive behaviour therapy for the masses on the cheap. And a grateful nation thanks you. Well, I do. My question is, to what extent do you believe we should shrug our shoulders in the face of the infection you've spoken of? Because it's the product. What would you expect from a not well-functioning deliberative democracy that we have in this country? And you may want to speculate about how you can put that right, but you may not have thought about it.
I think in terms of the real fears of a fascistic resurgence, we're all right for now, actually, compared to Italy, to Hungary, to Poland and to America. But if Brexit is a disaster, if we leave with no deal, then there will be a gap. And history suggests that it is a gap into which very malevolent forces move very, very quickly, while the rest of us are still sitting around wringing our hands and knitting our brows. So, I mean, on my tiny personal level, just keep calling it and grow another layer of skin next time you come under attack from these people. Just keep calling it, keep describing it. Call a concentration camp. You know, don't call it a tent city. Be honest and learn the lessons of history, because everyone in this room knows the quote about what happens if you don't learn the lessons of history. And at the moment, we seem to be in a period of collective amnesia about the lessons of history. There's also a weird English flavour to it, and I wonder if this would help, tackling this more. Mum and Dad raised me and my sister to believe that, in the words of Bugsy Malone, we could have been anything we wanted to be. And I thought everyone got raised like that. It's a bit odd. I come from quite a humble background, but my dad did quite well. He ended up on the Telegraph and he sent me to public school. And I only realised after he died that part of the reason why he did that was because his upbringing and his facility with the English class system had held him back. He was on the Daily Telegraph. He would have been overtaken by a less talented but more urbane son of a duke or an Eton-educated leader writer. So he sent me to Ampleforth, and I can walk that walk and talk that talk, but I can't believe how deferential the English are. Mm. I can't believe that Jacob Rees-Mogg, by dint of wearing a monocle, has his nonsense go utterly unchallenged, and that Boris Johnson, by adopting the faux trappings of a pantomime toff, manages to get away with absolute murder. This is a man whose personal, professional, and political lives have been mired in career-ending scandal, pretty much from the moment he got sacked from the Times newspaper traineeship for making up a quote from his own godfather. But because he's posh, huge swathes of the English population give him a free pass. And I think we need to tackle that, because I'm pretty sure that if someone does rise to the top of a profoundly broken Britain, it will be someone pretending to be posh.
But also, it's your theme of your book and your show. Nobody questions people. Nobody asks the question why. And we are in this weird, crazy situation where never have the aristocracy been so close to the working classes. Yes. in so many ways. Now, we're just going to take some more questions. There was a gentleman at the front. We'll have to go to this gentleman here. And are there any other women that want to ask a question? Because I'm quite conscious it's being quite male. And there's a lady at the back. We'll just take the questions in. Yeah, so gentlemen over there first.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question about the situation we have with social media. Yeah. Social media very much, you know, sort of, presents, you know, sort of opposites, and we react to that. But also, it seems to exist in an age of reduced agency, where we have less, we're offered more reasons to complain, but given less chance to actually do anything about it. And I think, in some ways, this sort of leads onto the malaise that we have in our politics and society at this point.
Yes, it's the football effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Twitter lends itself. I love Twitter. I'm far too much, actually, because I use it as a news source, and I this will sound really pretentious, but I think writing a well-crafted tweet is a bit like doing a haiku. But what it does is massively amplify and magnify that invitation to pick a side and start shouting without analysing. So it comes back to your question. Maybe social media is, I don't need to think about this. I know what to think. And look, here's someone famous who thinks exactly what I think. So I don't even need to think why they think what they think. I'm just going to repeat what they think and pass it off as what I think. And damn with the other lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, social media must be. And Facebook seems to be waking up a bit late to the dangers of its algorithmic manipulations. Twitter similarly to its... the final chapter of the book, the epilogue of the book, when I've submitted the draft, when I submit the manuscript, contained a few suggestions for improving things. And top of the list were Paul Dacre leaving the editor's chair at the Daily Mail and Alex Jones, the lunatic on InfoWars, being taken off social media. So I was delighted when that happened, with time for me to do a rewrite. I don't know what I'd put third on that list, but we seem to be moving, just nudging perhaps in the right direction.
Mm. I'm going to come to that lady then. I'll come back to you, sir, if that's all right. Yeah.
Hi, James. I listen to you every day, and the worst thing about it is, because I agree with a lot of what you say, I never ring in, I just kind of listen. But what I want to, the question I have for you is, at the end of all of that, I'm usually feeling more angry and more, yeah, because of the people that call in, and just feeling more frustrated. And I want to know what to do with that frustration. I'm not going to write a book, so
why not?
It's a good question. Because I haven't got around to it, actually.
That's why you tune in every day.
Yeah. So, whilst I'm writing the book, what to do?
Well, I take oh man, you put me in that position where I have to be really self-aggrandizing, because you learn stuff when you listen to the program. You learn how flimsy a lot of these very, very strongly held positions are, how flimsy the opinions that inform the positions are. So you help me find ways to tug the thread that will see the whole suit fall apart, like all my callers do. Most of my callers are actually quite uplifting and enlightening. It's only when you get the rock in the shoe, the stone in the shoe, that it becomes discomforting. And take it to the... You'll have people in your life who believe all of the things that people who ring my show in a right old tizzy believe. So just practice on them.
Spread the word. Gentleman over here with the white shirt.
I feel a bit bad asking this question because there have been some really good ones, but it's really interested me every time I listen, is because you've got some choice, quite unflattering and hilarious names for one of your colleagues in particular.
Yes.
And I just wonder, has that ever led to like an awkward situation in the lift at the canteen? Or
you refer to the man I generally describe as a despicable belch of beery flatulence. But, of course, the beauty of that is I don't need to tell you who I'm talking about. Which means it works a treat. So, no, I don't. We don't cross paths. And if we do, I think we pretend not to have noticed each other.
You have a line, actually, in your epilogue which says that journalists shouldn't get too friendly with
Absolutely
their,
agree, yeah.
And do you think there's been too much
Huge
of that,
problem.
That cozying up?
Huge problem. Because, to go back to your question, so some of these people, some of these positions, some of these arguments are rank. And they are leading to go back to your question at the back, the divisions and the fractures and the fissures that are growing wider in every level of our society. And if your job is to hold to account the people disseminating this divisive rhetoric, but you're going to go for a glass of wine afterwards, or you get invited around to each other's houses for dinner, or you agree to disagree, or you... I don't know, it might give someone quite a hard time in the studio, but not too hard, because you want a quote off them on the back of your next book, you're part of the problem. And I mean, political journalists who are reporting news from the lobby need to keep everybody on side. So someone like Tim Shipman on the Sunday Times, untouchable. Superb journalist, contacts book, size of War and Peace. Everyone talks to him, which is why his books and his journalism are so good. But if you're presenting, I don't see why you have to socialise with any of these people ever, from either side. Something happened during the expenses scandal. My wife made friends with the wife of a Conservative MP. We're still married. and it meant that we went round to their house for dinner. And then he got fingered, like almost everybody else did, during the expenses scandal. And I felt... that I mean, I don't know why, but I felt my guns had been spiked because I know him socially. So I kind of took my foot off the pedal and I got a note off him saying thank you, and I felt awful because I wouldn't have done that if I didn't know him socially. So I haven't socialised with a politician since. Of any hue, any. I mean, my oldest mate's dad is... a knighted, highly, high profile Eurosceptic. But I've known him since I was 13 years old. So I won't ever talk about him on air, because I love his son, and his son is my daughter's godfather. But anybody else is fair game.
I'm just conscious of time. Yeah, so wrap up. I just have one final question, sort of chair's prerogative, which is, you know, you are so thoughtful, you debate a lot of these things with actually more kind of openness and intensity and honesty than a lot of our politicians do, to be honest. You are, I think, at the coalface of debating not just the big political but the social and the cultural issues that are dominating our age. What's next for you? Do you ever think, I should try and fix this, I should run for office, or I should try and get into politics? Who would like to see James involved in politics here? Ah, maybe the leader of our new party.
I think that was muted. That's the word they use, isn't it? Muted applause.
What do you, do you ever think, I want to get, I know I've done all this diet, I want to get stuck in and try and fix it now, and I could do a better job than half those people in Parliament?
I don't know that I could. I mean, I have moments, of course I do, because of the overdeveloped ego and the the sense that perhaps I've been serving up something in recent years that no one else is. But I also, I do believe that political ambition should be the disqualifying factor for political office. I wish we could create a society in which anybody who wanted to be a politician was banned from being a politician. But that would involve a sort of form of thought policing that I'm not comfortable with. And then if the gentleman's question about what might be around the corner, if the tides of history are going to repeat themselves, makes you wonder whether you should do something, or whether you actually wield more power, odd though it may sound, as a member of the Fourth Estate than you ever could as a politician. And then there's the fact that my wife really doesn't fancy it, which is really important as well, actually, because I can't go into politics if she doesn't want me to. So, you know, also, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing.
And we are very much enjoying what you're doing. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a huge round of applause for the brilliant James O'Brien.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.